Am I doing the welcome or is somebody on Zoom doing the welcome?
No, you are.
I'm doing it. Okay. Let's do this. All right. I did not bring the right glasses for this. I'm supposed to have my non-progressive progressives. I don't have them. All right. Well, I will go in. Hold on. I got to adjust here. I can't see anything. I'll go from my right and say hello to Bob. Good morning, Andy in San Diego.
Andy.
Is that Mary? Hi, Mary.
Mary.
Shiketsu.
Rosemary.
Rosemary.
Dennis Q.
Ellen.
Ellen.
Brandon.
Vin.
Good morning, sir. Paula, Brian O'Toole, Bruce, Jane, Mark, Amelia, Paulette, Ebby, Jim, and then I have more on the other screen. How do I get over there again? How do I get to the other screen again? Anybody remember? I'm so used to doing it on a mobile device.
There may not be another screen.
Yeah, I think that's it.
Oh, is that everybody? It says 20. I guess that's 20 people. Wow, 20. Can 20 people fit on the screen? Well, all right, and then here in the Zendo, I'll let you say your own name.
Katie.
Hi, Katie.
Katie.
Kazu.
Jinryu.
Jinryu.
Dave.
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 Leah.
Alice.
Alice. Good morning, everyone. Did you have announcements?
Yes, I do. Is it too much trouble if I kneel in your place? Just kneel there.
Please.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make a few announcements because it's a very, very busy week at Brightways Inn. On Saturday, we have a retreat. Can you see me? No, you can't. On Saturday, we have a retreat. I don't know the exact times, but if Domio were here, she would have the details, and the details would be in the newsletter or on the website. And that's for people online as well as people in person. And then we also have the book group. And so people who are interested in that, let someone know or let Mary know. And Sunday we have the Vaisak ceremony, which is a ceremony that honors the Buddha's birth. And I wanted to announce this one in particular because we need at least one or two more volunteers. What we do is before the ceremony, we will decorate a pretty large bower with flowers. And that activity takes 30 minutes because I have done this every year for the past number of years. But right now we only have myself and Yeshe Soki doing it. So if we had another person or another two, it would be great. It means that you need to be here in the Zendo Pacific time at 8:45.
And I can be there, Jinryu.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
And anybody else is welcome. Bring flowers to decorate with, real or artificial, from your yard, from a grocery store, whatever. And then the ceremony has been sort of pared down a little bit to accommodate folks on Zoom as well as the folks here in the Zendo, and it will take place of our chanting. So it will start at 9:30 Pacific Daylight Time, which is why we need people here at 8:45. So I think that's it. Anybody think of any other announcements? Thanks.
That darn bench. So, hello everyone. It's good to see you all. Very grateful for the opportunity to speak to you today. Just had a couple of little points to make before I get into the meat of the discussion today. I have a feeling everybody here knows me. I think there may be one or two people that I haven't met virtually or otherwise yet, but if you saw the newsletter, discussion today is going to be talking about a few of my favorite things. Now, of course, that phrase evokes images of Julie Andrews spinning around in Austrian hillsides, but of course, that's not what we're here to talk about today, even though Dogen himself may appreciate the contemplation of things like roses on raindrops and whiskers on kittens, so that's not really the point for today. But what we are here to talk about, and what I mean by my favorite things, is some of my favorite passages from various Zen texts that I have come to know and love. And more importantly than just favorite passages, those passages that had a really profound impact on my practice and on me as a person. The ones that, when I read them, I didn't just say, oh, interesting, and move on. I literally did this, you know, and like had this, I wouldn't call it a light bulb moment, because that would mean that I understood what was happening. It was more like something resonated, something spoke to me in that moment that I read that particular passage. And I literally, in a lot of cases, had to put the book down and give it some thought for a while, to literally like not even touch the book again for a few days and just let this thought roll over and over in my mind. And I won't claim that I actually have an understanding of the full depth of or the truth of the things that I've read, but I will definitely claim that it has had a profound impact on my practice and has altered the direction of how I view my practice and how I enact and enable my practice. So, now, the thing that always strikes me a little odd about these types of discussions is, you know, passages from Zen texts, and I've got all these books down here, you know, stacks of them, and I'm going to read a few things out of them. But like, wait a minute, aren't we like the practice of that's beyond words and letters, you know, which is an edict that a lot of people have taken too far to the nth degree, maybe. And there are traditions, there are groups that say, well, we're not going to read anything at all. You know, it's just all sitting all the time, no sutras, no nothing. Okay, maybe that's one extreme. The other extreme, of course, would be attaching to those words and letters and making the sutras out to be more than they were meant to be, to, you know, take the words very literally and take them as the truth in and of itself. And then, you know, use those and hold them up and point to them like some sort of scripture doctrine that says, here, you're doing this wrong and you're doing that right. So how do we find that middle point between those two extremes, where we use the words and letters to go beyond the words and letters? So a common metaphor that's popped up in a lot of teachings and that I like myself is to say, you know, we're taking these words and letters, we're taking even our own greed, anger, and ignorance, our own delusion, and we're not trying to get rid of it, we're trying to transform it. We're using it, not as some evil that needs to be exorcised, not exorcised, but exorcised, right? Like the movie with the priest, what was that movie? Never mind, I'm getting on a tangent, I shouldn't do that. But to view that delusion as, hey, this is something I can work with. This is a stone that I can lay on the path along the way, along the Buddha way. So, the good thing about texts and podcasts, now we have our technological equivalent to reading a book, and that's listening to a podcast. And I do a lot of this. And the benefit of reading books and listening to podcasts is maybe somebody says something just at the right time, just in the right way, that it resonates with us. Maybe it's not even something we've never heard before. It's maybe something that we've heard many times. But just the way that that person said it at that time, on that place, and where we were, our mental and emotional and physical space at that moment in time allowed us to then take in its wisdom and accept it for what it is and have that aha moment. And that's true for the passages I'm going to share with you today. More often than not, I read it and say, wow, mind-blowing, pew, there it goes, you know, now I got to sit with it and think about it. And I would come back to it later, or I would come to another text later, or a podcast or whatever, and I say, wait a minute, that wasn't anything new, I heard that before. It was just this teacher saying it, or it was this text that I read that said the same thing, but it was this one that said it in a different way that really kind of punched me in the gut and changed the way that I looked at things. One other metaphor that I really like, in addition to stones that we can lay down on the path, is to think about every time that we have some sort of insight, even if it's just a little tiny, tiny little moment of opening, moment of realization where we say, oh, right. You know, it's not that we're learning something new. It's that we're uncovering something, discovering something that we've known all along. And this is a very common Zen trope that we aren't really discovering new lands. It's that there's a clear, still pool of water that is our Buddha nature that's currently covered up by all the detritus of our life, all of our greed and our anger and our ignorance and our preferences and our likes and dislikes and all these things. And our practice is meant to slowly pull the layers off. This branch here, this piece of discarded wood there, this piece of garbage there, until we're finally able to see, oh, I can see a little bit of the pool through the gap between that, you know, cereal box and that piece of wood. You know, there's the pool. I can see it there. And so our practice is really the ongoing, continuous practice of pulling pieces off. And as pieces pile back on, we pull those off too. And just keep up the practice of pulling the garbage off of the top of this clear, still pool of our Buddha nature. And so I find these texts to be helpers, right? They're little cranes or little, I'm sorry, that's not a very good analogy. I can't come up with a good one right off the top of my head, but they're helpers that help me to pull some of that detritus off. And I'm sure every word that's coming out of my mouth right now, hopefully you have all felt or have seen, and I'm sure you all have had similar experience. So I'm speaking on all of our behalves, I think. And I hope. So what I'd like to do is I'm going to share with you a couple of these passages, and I'm going to talk very briefly about what they opened up for me or how they made me look at things in a different way. For sake of being really thorough, I think what I'll do is I have a bibliography of sorts, my graduate school music research class coming back to haunt me now. I do not have my MLA style manual or Chicago style manual, so forgive me for improper bibliographic notations, but I will take a big bibliography of all the texts I'm going to refer to today and the page numbers that have the specific passage that I liked, and I will, after the service today, when I get home, I'm going to post it in the Google group. And I'll make clear, you know, as per my talk today, here's a bibliography of the texts and the page numbers that I was referring to, in case anything I say piques your interest, piques your desire to learn more. And what I would really, really like, because I don't know if time permitting we'll have time for this, but I will leave some time after I've said a few things for anybody to share if there's a particular passage that pops to your mind that you carry around with you. I'd love to hear that. I'm sure everybody would love to bask in the glow of your wisdom as well. But if you can't think of anything or it doesn't come to mind, what I would really like is if that thread, when I post that bibliography and I point out those passages, that if there is a specific Zen text, you get back, you know, you go to your library and like, oh yes, I really find that passage in this book. Please reply to the thread that I start. And maybe we can get a kind of a robust conversation going there in the Google group that will help everybody, you know, maybe call to mind something that we hadn't heard of or hadn't read and that we would like to now pursue. All right. So that said, let me get started. I had to dig through my pile here. So first, kind of an honorable mention, because there's not necessarily a specific passage in this book that really stands out. But it's more of the whole thing, its existence in and of itself. And this is Thich Nhat Hanh, being peace. Now, I did flag one particular part that really stood out to me at the time I read it, and I'll explain to you why it stood out to me at the time. Quote, "We are so busy, we hardly have time to look at the people we love, even in our own household, and to look at ourselves. Society is organized in a way that even when we have some leisure time, we don't know how to use it to get back in touch with ourselves. We have millions of ways to lose this precious time. We turn on the TV, we pick up the telephone, we start the car, and go somewhere." We could probably browse Facebook now on that too. "We are not used to being with ourselves. And we act as if we don't like ourselves and are trying to escape from ourselves." It's particularly that last sentence that really hit me in the gut when I first read it. We are not used to being with ourselves, and we act as if we don't like ourselves and are trying to escape from ourselves. The importance of this book in my practice is that this book is single-handedly responsible for me being here today, talking to you. It is what started my Zen practice, my Buddhist practice in general. Before I picked up this book and opened it, I had no knowledge of Buddhism. I had no intention of ever pursuing Buddhism. I was just kind of dealing with my own stuff and trying to, make my way through life, so to speak, and having challenges. And that phrase was the first phrase I was like, oh, okay, there's something here. And then there's quite a few references in this book that really actually confused me a lot at the time. And it was this general idea that the pursuit of happiness can be the cause of suffering. Getting the things we want can sometimes be the cause of our suffering. And I really struggled with that one when I first read it, because I thought, wait a minute, isn't that what life is about? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? Like, aren't we supposed to be chasing down the good things and trying to get rid of the bad things? And so this idea that, no, that's actually making it worse. Chasing after the good things and rejecting the bad things is what is actually causing you to suffer the most. It's not the bad things that you can't get rid of or that keep coming your way. And it's not the good things that you can't keep or that you can't acquire. That's not what's causing your suffering. It's the act of clinging and averting that's causing the suffering. And that one really knocked me for a loop, and I did have to put the book down. What's funny is I haven't even read the entire thing yet. I've gotten a couple chapters in, and it just was like, whoa, it was so disorienting at the time, because I was so just mired in delusion. And I'm not to say I'm not mired in delusion still, but at least I can recognize that I'm mired in delusion, where prior to reading this, I just had no concept. Like, I thought that this is just the way it is. Like, this is just life, right? I didn't know that there was another way to look at life. So that set the ball rolling down my Buddhist study and my involvement in initially the Thai forest tradition, and then Rinzai Zen, and now I'm here. So I think it's poignant that I started my very first reading of anything Buddhist was a Zen text. So I like that little gift it gave me. Okay, so that's one. The other one that really knocked me out, I should have organized this stack of books, but I did not. I don't know where I put it. Oh, here it is. Okay. It's from this book. Now, and actually the teaching, the first time I heard this wasn't in this book, but I thought this was just the best current source for it. This is a copy of the Denko Roku, The Transmission of the Light. This particular text is actually directly related to this tradition in that it was overseen by Reverend Hubert Nierman and Jiu Kennett herself, and published through Shasta Abbey. So this is a really nice text. And Jiu Kennett makes an interesting point in the introduction that she uses text formatting to highlight important points. So she'll put things in all caps when it's like, this has to do with actual Buddha nature, like really, really important stuff, kind of like they do in the Bible, I guess, the same concept. So I won't be able to read the all caps versus the mixed case, but I'll give it my best attempt to call attention to where she has capitalized. This is a very familiar story in the chapter on Great Master Tozan Ryokai, whose name we chanted this morning in the chanting service. When Tozan was taking his leave from Wungan, he respectfully inquired, "After 100 years, if someone were to ask me to describe the truth that you taught, how exactly should I reply?" After a long pause, Ungan responded, "Just say that this is it." Tozan sank deep into thought. Ungan said, "Ryokai Acharya, in order to understand the truth, investigate the matter thoroughly." Tozan was still embroiled in his doubts, but later, as he was crossing a river, he caught a glimpse of his reflection in the water and, greatly enlightened as to this previous principle, composed a poem. And then there's this enlightenment poem that we're all familiar with, but the phrase in the enlightenment poem that I think really stands out is, "Now I am going alone, everywhere I am able to meet him. He is me now, but I am not him." And so, of course, that very famous story of just this is it, and the Dharma of Suchness from Dongshan and his teacher, Yunyan, very, very, very famous Zen teaching. But what really struck me about this, and I had to think about a lot was, and sit with a lot, was this idea that, oh, just this is it, right? Just this, like, without all of the drama, but including the drama of daily life, not based on my idea of who I am and who I am not, but including my idea of who I am and who I am not. Like, it's just this. There's not something else. And this idea that the practice is really about trying to find that, to try to go deeper and deeper. And as, and there's another text, of course, I'll refer to, but as Dogen says, to turn the light around that illuminates the self. Like, the self isn't just, you know, little James Gregg, 53-year-old white male, father, husband, blah, 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 but is bigger than that, you know. To turn that light around to illuminate a self that I'm shining the light inward, but I'm actually shining the light outward at the same time. And so this idea that just this, and some translations, they say that Yunyan's actual intent was to say just this person is it. Like, this idea of what basically comes down to suchness, that it's just this. Like, it's so hard to really wrap one's head around that idea, because we're so used to stepping outside of just this. Like, just this is not good enough. You know, I'm just chugging along in life and trying to pay the bills and feed the kids and do all, that's not enough. There's got to be something more, right? And so it ties back to what I said before, where because we feel like just this is not enough, that we're chasing all these things. We're chasing after ways to entertain ourselves. We're chasing after ego identity. Who am I going to be today? And we're trying to get rid of and reject and kill off the things about ourselves and about our lives that we don't like. So this constant clinging and rejecting and clinging and rejecting that we think is life, when really it's just this. It's none of those things, and it's all of those things at the same time. And how can we just let that be without chasing or without rejecting? How can we just let this be it? You know? And that phrase knocked me on my butt so hard that I even had to get it tattooed on my arm. I've got just this right here, just so I can look at it. It's facing me. It's not for anybody else. It's just for me to look at, you know, that I can look down and say, yes, just this, just this, just this. It's a little practice reminder. Okay, let me do it. So, another one that really got me. This one's not specifically a Zen text, but it's maybe pre-Zen, if you want to look at it that way. The book is, it's actually a very interesting book. I heard about from a talk that Norman Fisher gave, where he actually gave a, I think it might have been a series of talks instead of just one, on this particular text. This book is called Verses from the Center. This particular edition translated and commented out by Stephen Batchelor. And what it really is he took a poem from Nagarjuna, and he retranslates some of the text, and then again he comments out on it. And you know, Nagarjuna's prose is obviously wonderful in and of itself. But the part of the book that I just found absolutely fascinating was just Stephen Batchelor's introduction itself. And there was an extremely powerful phrase that I loved that I think sums up the entirety of my practice, and I don't know, maybe think that it might sum up the entirety of yours too. Now, this phrase that I'm about to share with you, he's actually saying it in relation to trying to create ego identity, like our attachment to who we are in the world, and how can we get rid of that? And what he's talking about is saying, you know, the clinging to ego identity is delusion, but so is trying to get rid of ego identity. That is also delusion. And there's a fun little phrase. This isn't the phrase that really knocked me out. But Nagarjuna says, "I am free. I cling no more. Liberation is mine. The greatest clinging is to cling like this." So this clinging to enlightenment, so to speak. Nagarjuna is saying, that's just more clinging, you know. But anyway, the phrase that Stephen Batchelor puts in the book that just completely floored me. He's saying, to be free from such longing for enlightenment, clinging to enlightenment, to be free from such longing entails the patient, ongoing cultivation of an intelligence that is acutely alert to the danger of self-deception. To be free from such longing entails the patient, ongoing cultivation of an intelligence that is acutely alert to the danger of self-deception. And that was one of those phrases, I had to read that 5 or 6 times and just take each little section of the sentence apart and look at it in its own right, and it dawned on me, like, that's the practice, that's it, right there, in one sentence. Cultivating, or the patient ongoing cultivation of an intelligence that's acutely alert to the danger of self-deception. Like, right, that's the whole thing right there. And I think that, for me, that was the crux of delusion, as I referenced before when I first came across the Being Peace book, was I just thought that this was what it was, that this is how it is, this is life, right? You chase after the good stuff, you reject the bad stuff, and sometimes you get the good stuff, and sometimes you can't stop the bad stuff, and oh well, and you just gotta, you know, try to make it work, and just keep chasing and keep rejecting, keep clinging and keep rejecting, and then you die, you know. And this idea that there is a way to step back from that entire practice of clinging and rejecting and clinging and rejecting is basically self-deception. Not only fooling our small selves into believing that that's life and that that's what we need most, we need to get the good and reject the bad, but also self-deception in terms of the big self, right? I'm deceiving my larger self by assuming and pretending that I am just me, that I'm this individual person, and you are you over there, and you're not like me, and you're not like me, and nobody else is like me, and I'm an individual, and I'm special, and I'm unique, and so is everybody else. Great, but I'm me, and I'm the really special one here. You know, my needs are what's most important. That is not only a deception of our small self, but also our big self, that we're deceiving ourselves into completely ignoring the large self, that there's more to it than that. There's something bigger. And that the practice is really about just constantly bringing awareness to that. And so I've taken that phrase and I've even started bringing it to mind in specific moments where I say, am I deceiving myself right now? You know, am I fooling myself here? I probably am. You know, it's a little bit of healthy self-doubt, right? Or great doubt, maybe. we wouldn't even call it self-doubt, but we'll call it great doubt. Like, what is this really? And what am I trying to do really? And is this really important? Because it seems like it is, but maybe it's not. And to just be able to constantly have that kind of an objectivity, almost like there's a part of consciousness that's feeding back on consciousness and saying, okay, watch out, James. Like there's a little, maybe the angel on the shoulder, to use that old stereotype, right? There's always that angel on the shoulder saying, whoop, watch out for that, watch out for that, watch out for that. And that most of us go through life just, go away, angel. I'm not interested in what you have to say. I don't want the devil either, but I certainly don't want the angel telling me what to do. You know, that we like that self-deception, right? In our deluded mind. We like to think that things are important that ultimately maybe aren't, right? And so we find ourselves mired in all sorts of activities and thoughts that just continue our suffering because of that. So I love that idea of, and I like the ongoing, the patient ongoing cultivation part of that phrase really stuck with me because I see a lot of echoes of Dogen's teaching on Gyoji, on continuous practice. That is just, it's constant. You've got to do it. Like every second of every day, as much as you possibly can, you bring that wisdom to mind. You bring that wisdom to bear on every moment that you're experiencing and say, is this real? Is this necessary? Right? Even about the things that we think. It doesn't even have to be an external, like I'm, you know, looking at a chocolate cake. Should I really eat that entire chocolate cake? Yes, I should. Oh, wait, I'm deceiving myself into thinking I need the chocolate cake, right? But more of a just like that internal thought process of, you know, I don't like what that person said to me. They don't respect me. To have that little angel on the shoulder saying, well, that's not necessarily true, James. There may be more to the story than just the fact that you thought that they said something rude to you. Maybe they, really what was going on there is that they have some pain and suffering of their own, you know, and that just always have that second opinion, so to speak, for the things that we think and things we say. There's a great quote by the Thai forest teacher Ajahn Sumedho that I love, that I also carry around. Your thoughts aren't real and they aren't even yours. You know, and I think that's a perfect counterpoint to this idea that you just got to keep it going. You got to keep the train rolling and just remember, hey, this thought that you're having, it's not even real. It's not even yours. You know, is this real? Are you deceiving yourself? Or, you know, and to just always bring that awareness to bear. Okay, I think I'm going to share one more. Yeah, I'm going to share one more and then I'm going to open it up. And if nobody has anything to say, I have a couple other things I can mention, or a couple other texts I can mention. But. All right. What I love about this exercise I'm going through right now is that all of you have probably seen these many times, some of these books many times, so hopefully you've come across some of the same teachings or phrases that I found important, or maybe not. Maybe you kind of blew right past them because they didn't mean anything to you at that point in your life or that point in time to where you were in your mental, physical, emotional space, but maybe you come back to it. Maybe it will. Okay. This one from very, very famous text. Too glossy. I'm getting the reflection there. Realizing Genjo Koan, Shohaku Okamura's very, very, very in-depth analysis of this famous fascicle in Dogen's Shobogenzo. And the part of it that struck me, it's actually an entire chapter, but I'm not going to read, or subsection of an entire chapter. And it's particularly around the part where he's talking about life, death, and time. And it's specifically in the Genjo Koan itself, it's the part where Dogen is referring to firewood and ash. That we should not think of firewood as before and ash as after. Right? Firewood abides in the Dharma position of firewood and ash abides in the Dharma position of ash. And that fascicle in and of itself is, I think, very profound and really helped me, like to actually visualize firewood and ash in terms of cause and effect. Like I see ash, I can say, well, there was firewood before, but what's really most important is that it's ash now. Now we're looking at ash, right? So the fact that there may have been firewood before is not really the point, that now we're dealing with ash, right? And that's a very unskillful way to summarize that, but that was kind of where I came from. Here it is. The Dharma positions of tree, firewood, and ash are all independent of one another. And when we use this as an analogy for birth, living, and dying, each Dharma position seems to have a length of time. But in reality, each stage or Dharma position of living and dying can only be experienced in the present moment. And the present moment does not have any length. If the present moment did have a length, no matter how short it were, we could divide it into a half that was already in the past and a half that was still in the future. When I say the word now, as I pronounce n, the ow is still in the future. And as I pronounce ow, the n is already in the past. So the present moment has no length, a length of zero. This is to say the present moment, the present moment is empty. So that one totally blew my mind. I've long been fascinated by the intersection of Buddhism and quantum physics. And I saw, not that I know anything about quantum physics, I don't have that kind of a technical brain, but the idea that in quantum physics that where they say, you know, really at its most fundamental level, you get down far, farther and farther and farther, and you keep dissecting the particles, and you get your atoms and your protons and neutrons and your quarks, and you keep going further and further down to a quantum level. There's nothing there. And they've been able to, you know, prove, big quotes there, prove this by measuring electrons, you know, shooting electrons at a device and whatnot, seeing how they scatter and all this type of thing. And they basically, you know, say, well, you know, you cannot measure a particle, or you can't know the weight of a particle or the position of a particle until you measure it. So it's almost like the particle knows it's being measured, and then it appears in a specific spot. But before you measure it, it's in a completely unknown, improbable state. It could be anywhere. We don't know. That's a very, very poor definition of some of the quantum physics position on this. But I thought that relates very nicely, because there's really nothing there. You get further and further down, there's nothing there. And in terms of time here, he's talking about past and future and present. And I actually, after I read this, I tried to sit with it, you know. I sat in my zazen and I was like, okay, this present moment. How can I dissect it? You know, keep dissecting. Do I ever get something that I can no longer dissect, right? And if we talk in terms of minutes and seconds, for instance, you could take a second and you can divide it, right, into milliseconds and so on and so on and so on and so on. But you will never not be able to divide whatever unit of time you come up with. You'll never not be able to divide it into a smaller unit of time, right? And so that present moment that you're supposed to live in, right? We talk all the time, yeah, live in the present moment. You know, I am here now. And, you know, this present moment is all there is. Just this, right? There's nothing there. It doesn't really exist. It's always, for our human minds in particular, it's always some self-referential combination of past and future, right? And of course, law of karma, cause and effect, and all that bears that out to the degree that, hey, you know, I said words a half a second ago, and now I'm saying other words. Well, that was the cause, and now this is the effect. That was the firewood, this is the ash. You know, that was then, this is now. But by the time I say now, the end is in the past and the ow is still in the future. By the time I say ow, the end is in the past and there's some other word in the future. So all we can do is point to past and future. Even though we say live in the present moment, there's really nothing there. And what really blew my mind about that was what he says right there at the end. That basically that means that the present moment is empty. And here he's, of course, using the classic Buddhist and Zen definition of the word empty, that it is not one, right? It is one, not two, right? It's more than just a thing. It is everything, right? That the law of emptiness basically says, or the truth of emptiness basically says, empty of separate existence, right? And that's what emptiness really means. Empty of separate existence, which means everything is connected. Everything is the same. Everything is one. And so we look at that from the standpoint of time. We say, well, if the present moment is empty, then this is always the present moment. The past is the past, and the causal effects have led us to where we are now, and where we are now is going to be the causal effect for what happens next, and so on and so on and so on. But that single present moment is completely indivisible and is completely not even there. I probably should have ended my piece on something that wasn't so esoteric, but oh well, anyway, such as it is. All right, so we got a couple minutes, maybe more than a couple of minutes. I'm sorry?
You should have a clock on your right-hand side somewhere.
Oh, yeah, I do. Hey, look at that. There's a clock here. Thank you. I didn't see that before. So what I'd like to do is open it up to our physical Zendo, our Zoom Zendo, anyone who would like to, if there's a specific passage that you carry around with you that's resonated really well for you, that's become a part of your practice in some way, shape, or form, we would love to hear about it. So if you are on Zoom, you can raise your hand or unmute yourself. If you're here in the Zendo, you can speak up. Looks like Paula's got her hand up. Go ahead, Paula.
I also like the Being Peace book. It's a classic that I refer to a lot. And I read to my yoga class last week the passage in the book that relates to, and Ty is on a bus that his friend has arranged the trip to India for him. And they're traveling together on the bus. And his friend apparently belongs to a caste that has been marginalized in India for centuries. And Ty is aware that his friend is really nervous, even though he tries to help him relax. And he tells him what a great job he did organizing the trip and how just to relax. And my point of that, I read that passage many times and it didn't really hit me until I was reading it earlier this week, getting ready for the class I was teaching, and how much we're like that friend from the caste, that we get so caught up in kind of self-judgment often and feeling like we're not good enough for something. And we just can't let go of intergenerational stuff and stuff that we've accumulated on our own in this lifetime, and how, not in a judgment way, but at all, but this in an observational way, how human it is for us to do that. And, I could see that I could relate to being that guest or that organizer who organized a retreat and felt they weren't good enough, and that we all have that. We think, I can't meditate, I'm not good enough, or I can't do this, I'm not good enough, or whatever. And the part of it that really hit me was the intergenerational, the long established habit pattern of that way of thinking. Not to judge or anything, just to observe that we all share in that.
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest facets of our delusional state is we just love stories.
Yeah.
We love to tell stories about who this person is, who we are, and we like to stick to those stories. And we never consider, to your point, maybe there's really nothing to that story. Maybe that's completely fabricated. So thank you. I appreciate that. And Rosemary?
I have a question. When you were describing about having this little angel or a little devil, whatever you want to call it, that says to you, hey, you know, maybe it's not quite as you assume it to have been, and maybe you should look at it again. And you mentioned it's good if you have this conversation virtually throughout your life. Do you ever have difficulty with that? Because there's then too much conversation, and then you find yourself perhaps pulled even further away from what's going on, because there's a type of war between different voices. I find that for myself a little bit problematic. I think it's good to question your own position, knowing anyway that your position is only a small angle of perhaps a bigger whole. But I fight with it sometimes, because then I get into an extra kind of conversation that seems to pull me away from just being there or being able to observe. And I wonder if you have that experience too, or anybody else does.
Yeah, I know that's and I think that for a lot of us, that's part of the struggle, right? There's the two extremes of no conscience, let's call it conscience, for lack of a better word, right? There's that, the little voice in your head that says, hey, wait a minute, maybe you shouldn't, or maybe you should, or whatever, that there's either no conscience, right? And you just, and then you just fumble through life like a bull in a china shop, just knocking people over, and, you know, with no regard for what they may need, what they really want. Then there's the other extreme of, well, I'm going to sit here and I'm going to ponder this endlessly, and then I'm never going to actually get into the fray and act, right? Mm-hmm. And I think I may have mischaracterized what you said, but that was how what you said landed on me. And mm-hmm. I think that's part of finding that middle way is, you know, just enough conscience. Like we have to, at some point we have to trust ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. And I think one of the biggest struggles for a lot of us is, well, I don't. I don't trust my decisions, because I made so many horrible decisions that there's no way possible that I could be right about this. That there has to come a point where we say, well, this is what feels right. This is what seems right. And now I'm going to go forward and act with that. And I know I personally struggled a lot with that during the last few years around politics. Mm-hmm. And the way that politics intersected with the COVID, you know, restrictions and mandates and all that. And how it was so easy to tell that story. It was so easy to be lazy and just berate the other side for being completely stupid, completely ignorant, you know, out to just destroy humanity. Like, what's your problem? Like, it was really easy to fall into that trap. But the little angel, the little conscience, could allow me to step back from that and say, wait a minute, wait a minute. Maybe there's more to the story than what I'm perceiving, right? What my small mind is perceiving. Maybe there's something else to it. And to eventually, like, dig at it enough and work with it enough to say, oh, there's suffering there. You know, there's suffering that's informing these just horrible, antisocial and awful and damaging and behaviors and words and actions of just these awful people that we're having to deal with right now, that it's really because there's suffering at its core. There's fear at its core. And that allowed me to then, you know, finding that kind of, you know, watching the gauge kind of go like this, it kind of helped me to land on that. Okay, this is what I need to act from. I need to act from this place of compassion and understanding that it's really, you know, suffering and fear at the root that they probably don't even want to admit. And they're acting out because of it, yada, 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 right? And then now I can move forward with that. But if I just sat there in this, you know, if I stayed on the one extreme of, you know, freaking Republicans, man, and just wanting to constantly berate and be angry about that, or I just wanted to sit there and be like, well, you know, I have no preference for good or evil because I'm this, you know, I'm trying to cultivate this middle path between good and evil. Like, that's not helpful either. Mm-hmm. There was a Zen teacher up in Victoria, BC, that in the Rinzai tradition that actually had a funny way to say it. He's like, you know, some of these Zen people, you go into a room and you say, how do you all feel about the eating of babies? You take a baby and just eat it. That some of these people would be like, well, I am neither for nor against the eating of babies. It's like, come on. You know, there's got to be a point at which you use that compass to find a boop, okay, this is the right, I do not approve of eating of babies. You know, and that's an extreme example, of course, but That was what he was trying to, the point he was trying to make, is it's so easy to fall on one side or the other. And I think the people who do choose that far, far, like, well, I'm just gonna keep mulling this over, and I'm gonna be indecisive about it, and there's multiple sides to every story, and I'm not gonna really commit to one. That's, I think there's fear at the core of that too, you know. Fear of just make a decision and go for it. And sometimes you make the decision and you plow forth and you say, oops, that was a mistake. Okay, you know, back up and try again. And that's part of the practice too, right? That at least we're cultivating our own compassion, our own bodhisattva. We're trying to enact our bodhisattva vow. At least we're going into it with best intentions. Even if we mess it up, you know, at least we were trying to be compassionate and thoughtful of others in the process of doing so. So yeah, I think it's real easy to just kind of spin and spin and spin and spin and spin. And it's real easy to just stay mired in one viewpoint and one viewpoint only. So again, that cultivation, how do we bring those two together and find a skillful, decisive way to respond to a situation? Is, I think that's important and very challenging. So thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry, that was a very long response.
Thanks.
Paulette.
Thank you. I'm not sure I know what I want to say, so just bear with me. You were talking about like repelling and like, you know, aversion and the opposite of aversion, which is, I guess, clinging. I don't know. There's times when I have a really strong reaction to something because I feel it's really wrong. Like if somebody like abuses animals or, you know, just, and for me, it's like, kind of like what you were saying, we want to, it's coming from fear maybe and have compassion, but it's like, in the meantime, they're creating a lot of pain and a lot of suffering. So sometimes it's really hard for me to kind of, I mean, Republicans is something else, like, you know, like some of their viewpoints are damaging, but it's like there's people that are, and they are, but like directly hurting other people, you know, and directly causing pain and suffering to other people. So for me, or other beings, so for me, it's hard to kind of know, like I've struggled with this in Buddhism with the attachment and aversion, which we were talking about earlier. Because I don't really want to attach myself to my beliefs because then I become very like sort of stuck in a belief system. But at the same time, I don't really want to go there either. Like I don't want to really engage with that, that kind of behavior. So for me, it's hard to find that balance because I see like so much pain that these some certain people are causing and like, directly, you know, and a lot of it. So it's hard to kind of know how to respond. And I appreciate that you said you don't want to sit there while someone's eating babies. I know that's a ridiculous example, but it's kind of like, you know, they are directly hurting others. So it's just kind of hard to know what to do in that situation. It's like a lot comes up when I think about it. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. And that's the struggle. I think, you know, we have not chosen an easy practice because there's kind of almost what seems like competing, conflicting demands on us. Well, don't cling. Yeah, but this is really important. Okay, well, go ahead and do that. Well, don't avert. But yeah, but that's really bothering me. Okay. Like we have to, and I think I can't remember the teaching, but what I was first thinking of is the difference between sympathy and empathy, right? That sympathy means, you know, I see somebody hurting animals, right? And I'm like hurting with the animal, right? I'm right there with them, feeling their pain, mired in that agony with them. And there's a degree to which that doesn't allow you to actually help, because rather than trying to take the suffering being and pull them out of their suffering, you're just down there with them, and now you're both in the pit. You know, what are you gonna do? You're both, like another analogy, sorry I keep throwing them out, but you know, somebody's stuck in a well, a deep well. You know, does it do any good to jump in there with them? Like, hey, let me help you out. Oh, wait a minute. Now we're both stuck down here. So an empathetic response using empathy would be, okay, I'm going to not jump into the well. I'm not going to go there with them, but I'm going to stay in this balanced, centered place and try to assist them. And that requires, I think, the big skill, and Domio talks a lot about this in some of her talks, is that I think that requires the ability to bear witness, right? The ability to sit there and perceive the suffering of others and really be compassionate, you know, not be cold-hearted and completely, you know, neutral to it, but to be able to bear witness to it and take in the pain, but then turn it around into skillful action, to turn it around into trying, taking the suffering in and using it to try to ease the suffering. And there's actually a meditative practice that a lot of places do where you'll, you know, a bearing witness practice where you're sitting zazen and you breathe in the suffering of the world and then you breathe out compassion and ease for all sentient beings, right? And this practice of taking it in and then breathing it out. And you're not averting from it. You're not pushing it away. You're not clinging to it, right? Which is to go there with them. Like sympathy, if I jump into the well with you, then that's a clinging, right? I'm clinging to this idea of your pain and suffering that I need to try to help you out of, and I'm making it into this thing, rather than staying in my own centered place where I can now try to assist you, pull you out of the well, pull you out of that suffering, right? So I think an empathetic response, again, really, it takes just being able to stay put and bear witness, let it all come. Don't, you know, like, oh, haha, you know, like people that are, you know, crying and emotionally distraught, you know, and a lot of people get uncomfortable about that and they want to shy away, like even physically turning, like, okay, well, it looks like you need a little break. I'm going to leave you alone now. Like, that's not helpful, right? To be able to just sit there and bear witness and be present in that moment and then try to transform that suffering into assistance. So now, of course, if you saw somebody like literally beating an animal or something, right? There's a difference between immediate action and, you know, skillful, unskillful action. Like immediate action is, well, stop them. You know, it doesn't excuse you from the, you know, well, you know, it's kind of like the eating babies. Well, I'm neither for nor against the beating of animals. What right do I have to step in and save that animal from being beaten? Like, that's not helpful. Go stop the person, but stop them from a place of, hey, what is going on here? Animal, are you okay? Are you fine? Let me take care of you. Let me, you know, heal your wounds. Let me nurture you, right? And meanwhile, to the abuser, say, what is going on? Why are you doing this? And then try to help them. You know, because again, that those actions are so informed by their own suffering and their own fear. And that's hard, right? We just want to vilify the animal beater and help the animal. And we should help the animal, but we shouldn't vilify the person beating the animal. We should also be trying to help them. And that's hard. I hope that answered.
No, that was very helpful. Thank you. Thank you.
All right, Alice? And then we'll do Ebby. Did Ebby have
first, yeah.
Oh, okay. I couldn't tell who was first. Ebby, go ahead, please.
Hi. I haven't really got anything to say except that in the last few days, I have started to read a book that I just bought. I'd like to show you. Can you see it?
Yes.
Yeah. And It's quite a thick book, as you can see. And the first few pages, the one sentence that really struck me was, I'll post it.
Desire is the memory of pleasure. Fear is the memory of pain.
Ooh. And I haven't really had much time to process that. So, but it keeps coming back. You know, you said these phrases that you read, they keep coming back. I keep remembering them. So obviously something is going on there. But I thought I'd just like to share that.
Thank you. That's wonderful. Now you've given me another phrase that knocked me upside the head. I'm going to have to sit with. I appreciate it.
Okay, you're welcome.
There you go. Alice.
I hope I don't lose friends over this. I think we have to be really careful about not thinking so dualistically. I vote mostly Republican. And I feel like a pin could drop in here. And I'm coming out with that because that's just my position and that's how I think. But at the same time, I know I'm not in a group who votes the same way I do. And I know that there's multiple complex things going on and people see things differently. And I like that because sometimes when I see something I don't agree with, I go, okay, there's two or three layers behind this. And I want to understand those two or three layers behind it because to me, that's compassion. Is reaching out towards something that's really uncomfortable and really unwelcome, but then understanding that there's a lot of depth to it. For example, like I don't abuse animals by any means, but I was viciously attacked by a dog, like viciously. Like I had to go to the ER, I lost liters of blood. You know, I still have scars on my leg, I still have scars on my hand. My bone was like exposed for several hours in the ER while I waited for the doctor to suture me up. And the dog was owned by my brother, and it had to be put down. And I'm sorry to say this, but I have absolutely no sympathy for that dog because it like viciously attacked me. Now, in a Buddhist sense, maybe that dog perceived me as a threat, maybe that dog had, you know, multiple things going through its head and thought that I was dangerous. I certainly wasn't. I was tying my shoe. But, you know, I'm just trying to paint a picture that things are a lot more complicated than they seem. Mm-hmm. And I really, really hope I don't lose friends over this because I'm a complex person. I have a complex history. And I recognize that everyone does as well. And I don't think that there is a right way or a wrong way. I think we're all just trying to figure it out all together. Mm-hmm. And what a beautiful thing that is because we're all a blend. Mm-hmm. And I guess that also touches into faith because I have faith that we'll all try to figure it out. And there's a lot of pain and suffering along the way. But at the end of the day, if you're holding someone's hand, I think that's where you find compassion. So.
Understood. Well, thank you for your honesty. I appreciate that. And for vulnerability, right? I'll still be your friend. Don't lose me. Dave.
I had to run out and grab my phone because I wanted to make sure I didn't mess this quote up. Just so Alice doesn't feel alone, I'm an advocate for nuclear power. I think that eating meat is just fine. You know, I have all sorts of unpopular opinions. We all do, but the quote that I came up with that sticks with me all the time is, I don't know if y'all are familiar with the Blue Cliff Record. It's a Book of Koans, mm-hmm. Case 2.
Yeah.
And the one that comes into my mind all the time, it's just the opening sentence, is, the ultimate path is without difficulty, just avoid picking and choosing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. I actually had, that was one of the ones, if we needed more time, mm-hmm. I that first quatrain of the Verses on Faith Mind was mine. And I love that picking and choosing. I also like Richard Clark's translation, the great way is not difficult for those not attached to preferences. And I like that. You know, it's two ways to say the same thing, but it's not having preferences. It's about having them, but not attaching to them, not putting all of your identity and your worth into
those. And I think we've talked about, you know, particular examples of, you know, Republicans think this and this, that, but I think having different viewpoints is one thing. Saying that these people shouldn't exist or the world should not be this way is different. You know, I can feel one way or the other about, you know, the world I live in, but if I spend all my time thinking, well, I should have a full head of hair or I should be tall, I mean, that's not going to get you anywhere, right? That some conditions are just the way the world is. But then again, you see somebody who's about to get run over by a car, that's not the same sort of thing at all, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And these are very distinguishable cases, you know. So that's why that particular thing sticks with me.
Thank you, Dave. Yeah, I think it's just that ability to, at any given moment, to do I need immediate action? Do I need, you know, like, and there's a lot of teachings that say, you know, anger can be a really good thing. It's not, you know, Buddhism is not necessarily about, you know, well, just try to put away your anger at all costs, like never show it. Well, actually, there's skillful use of anger. And I think that's the word that's most important, no matter what we're talking about, is skillful use. You know, is it coming from a place of love, of compassion, empathy for all sentient beings, et cetera, et cetera? I don't think it matters so much what you call it. So, all right, we are over time, so I apologize. And I don't have the little chant memorized, so I'm just going to say, unless somebody else wants to do it, I'm going to just close it out. Thank you all for your time. Have a wonderful afternoon or evening, wherever you are in the world.
Thank you, James. Thanks so much.
Thank you, James.